Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Policymakers are alarmed that our federal debt has now reached $7 trillion. But in his new book, The Coming Generational Storm, Boston University economics professor Lawrence Kotlikoff warns of a future $45 trillion deficit, the result of the retirement of the baby boomers. Tonight on Point, what the looming deficit means for you and how you can prepare for it. We begin in Basra, where suicide bombers detonated car bombs during rush hour today, killing 68 people, including 16 children who burned to death in their school buses. The blast was a bloody wake-up call to the British-controlled city in southern Iraq. Mohammed Bazzi is the Middle East bureau chief for Newsday in Baghdad. I asked him for the latest on the investigation into the bombings.
Well, there were five suicide bombings. Four of them went off almost simultaneously in the morning in Basra. The fifth one was a little later in the day. And there were two other would-be suicide bombers who were arrested by the Iraqi police. The death toll right now is 68 people, 19 of them children. They were in a school bus that was near one of the bombing sites. And it's caused a tremendous sense of outrage in Basra, which had been relatively quiet in the past couple of weeks. Basra is controlled by the British, and it hadn't been seen to any large suicide bombings really previously. There had been some smaller bombings there, but unlike Baghdad and, say, Karbala and Najaf, it hadn't been the scene of a huge suicide bombing or series of bombings until today.
Well, as you say, the picture I think that most Westerners had up until now was that the Americans might have a mixed record in Iraq, but that the British had been pretty successful in their administration in Basra. So I take it it was truly a surprise that such a massive attack would happen there.
Basra is definitely held up as kind of a success story in Iraq. And this is getting a lot of people, again, to point the finger at foreign fighters, at possibly al-Qaeda-linked groups and sort of outside forces. There has been some gang-related violence in Basra. There's been some tribal violence that's happened over the past couple of months, but nothing at the scale of Baghdad. No one really thinks that sort of the general violence that's happened in Basra, over fights over smuggling and things like that, would spill into something this grand. And most of the sort of native forces in Basra, sort of either tribal or gangs, aren't really believed to be capable of carrying out something this huge. It has the same sort of hallmarks of previous synchronized suicide bombings, ones that happened in Najaf, ones that happened on the same day in Baghdad and Karbala, and several other bombings in Baghdad. So that's leading a lot of people to point to al-Qaeda type of groups. Abu Musab Zarqawi, who's been blamed by the Americans for orchestrating a lot of suicide bombings in Iraq.
This also seems to have been timed for maximum casualties, 7 o'clock in the morning, children on their way to school. Is there also the potential for a backlash here? I mean, among the civilian population being targeted in this way?
Some of the British troops that tried to respond to the scene of some of the bombings were pelted with rocks by people in Basra. Some of the TV footage showed sort of people screaming at the British troops. So there was kind of instant kind of backlash, a lot of people angry, perceiving that the British didn't do enough to protect people. There was a lot of anger caused by the death of these school kids. That's something that hasn't happened on this scale before, this many children killed in one bombing. I don't think that's happened yet in the past year. So there is definitely a backlash. There's also lots of rumors and conspiracy theories all over Iraq. There are rumors circulating in Baghdad today that that the occupation authority or either British forces or American forces were behind those kinds of things have been circulating after big attacks recently. And the violence of the last few weeks, both in Fallujah and with Muqtada's other supporters, kind of help give momentum to these sorts of rumors.
And as bad as this was, it could have been even worse. As you say, there were two other bombers captured before they could attack. What alerted police to their presence? Why were they taken?
Iraqi police have started looking out for the kinds of synchronized suicide bombings, sort of looking for multiple targets. And a lot of the bombers tend to use similar cars. It's not clear yet today, sort of, if they all use the same kind of car in all these bombings. But police have been on the lookout for certain kinds of cars, and they're on the lookout always that if one bombing happens, for multiple bombings to follow it. And so there's a kind of heightened security right after a bombing, and that happens in Baghdad. That happens in most cities where bombings happen.
And not much question that this is al-Qaeda's M.O.?
It definitely has the M.O. It has the hallmark of al-Qaeda. You know, there's a lot of debate about whether Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is actually present in Iraq. There's a document that the U.S. military released about 2 months ago that allegedly originated with him and kind of called for stepped-up attacks and efforts to kind of instigate a civil war in Iraq between Shiites and Sunnis. Basra is a largely Shiite city, very few Sunnis there. It's the second largest city in Iraq, and kind of place where that kind of spark for civil strife can happen. We've seen a lot of Sunni-Shiite cooperation lately all over Iraq, and especially around Baghdad and near Fallujah. It's been focused on helping people in Fallujah, sending supplies, donations, things like that. That's helped foster the sense of cooperation between Sunnis and Shiites. A lot of people have been talking about the improbability of civil strife between Sunnis and Shiites because of what we've seen around Fallujah. But these kinds of attacks, the car bombings that hit a heavily Shiite city could spark the kind of civil, mini-civil war, maybe, that al-Zarqawi might be hoping for.
Mohammed, thank you.
Thank you.
Mohammed Bazzi is Middle East Bureau Chief for Newsday. He spoke with us from Baghdad. By the year 2030, a combination of decreasing birth rates and increasing life expectancy will double the number of retirees in America, while the number of working adults will go up by only 18%. Using a methodology known as generational accounting, Treasury Department officials have calculated that long-term federal obligations will exceed revenues by $45 trillion. The result? Rampant inflation, skyrocketing tax rates, a depreciating dollar, and drastic cuts in Social Security and Medicare. Tonight on Point, we'll hear about the investment strategies you need to protect yourself financially from the coming generational storm. Are you afraid that the government won't be there to support you during your retirement? What is the proper balance between government responsibility and personal responsibility? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Lawrence Kotlikoff, professor of economics at Boston University, also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research and president of Economic Security Planning, a developer of financial planning software. And his new book is The Coming Generational Storm. Hi, Larry, and welcome.
Hi, Gail. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst and a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Gail. Hello, Professor.
Hey.
Larry, let me first congratulate you on a book that is, while alarming, also about the most entertaining text I think I've ever read about economics. You clearly work to make it simple and to keep our attention.
Thanks very much.
But, you know, this sounds more like a tsunami than a storm. How did we get in this mess?
Well, we got into this mess by not thinking about the future very systematically. We've been, and that's one of the things the book talks about, we've really been conspiring, not explicitly but implicitly at the government level, to keep the truth about what's coming from the public. Everybody has a sense that there's going to be lots of old people and that there's going to be a lot of bills to pay. But nobody, I think, really understands exactly how horrendously large these bills are, because you have this huge number of baby boomers, 77 million of them, who are going to be all retired in 2030. And they're going to be collecting these very large Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security benefits, which today per old person total $23,000. But these benefits, because nobody's watching the shop, are growing at leaps and bounds. Over the last 4 years, under both Clinton and President Bush, Medicare benefits per beneficiary grew 7 times faster than the real wages of the workers paying those benefits. So you don't have to be a rocket scientist or PhD economist to understand that you've got all these old people interacting with these benefits that are skyrocketing, and that's something that nobody's really wanting to tally up, but this book does.
And also fewer and fewer children. So essentially what you're saying is, hey, don't count on your kids to take care of you, and don't count on the government either.
Yeah, you may outlive your kids. You may not have kids. When you're 90, your kids might be 70, you know, 65. They may be in poor health. There's just not that many kids people are having these days. So, and they're also living all over the place. And then there's all this divorce going on. So that's not really a source to rely on.
Jack, what do you make of this? It's kind of scary for people who are in the baby boomer range.
It is scary, and it's the $44 trillion that was the real scary thing. I reported that on this program when the Financial Times, I think, first reported that this was an appendix. This study was an appendix to the budget, the 2003 budget. But the Treasury Department didn't want to release it because it would scare people too much.
Yeah, this study was actually commissioned by Paul O'Neill before he was fired. And the day he was fired, it was censored, or more or less the day he was fired. So it was not included in the president's budget. And today, actually, that was about a year and a half ago. Today, with this new Medicare drug benefit, the current fiscal gap, which is the calculation of the difference between all the spending we're going to do over time and all the taxes we're going to collect, that difference measured in today's dollars in what we call present value, the value in the present, is no longer $44 trillion, but it's actually $51 trillion today.
Yeah, but, you know, my first thought was, wow. My second thought was, this is steeper than anything I've seen before. For example, the Brookings study on Social Security. And then my third thought was, is this motivated exaggeration? That is, was the Treasury trying to gin up sentiment for privatizing Social Security by really making things seem dire? And sure enough, I went on and read one of the authors of the report. He was, in fact, in favor of privatizing accounts. Now, you're not. So you're not using the or not in the form he was talking about.
Right.
But then, you know, you look at things like, I've got a statement here from the American Academy of Actuaries that says, these long-term projections provide little, if any, useful information about the program's long-range finances, and indeed are likely to mislead anyone lacking in technical expertise into thinking the programs are worse off than they are. Basically, I agree with you that these things are dire, but what about things like this statement from the actuaries and things like the counting that this does? This counts Medicare doctors' fees as part of unfunded liabilities, which of course those doctors' fees are paid by general revenue, so it's not quite the same. Anyway, what do you make with these quibbles about the figure?
We actually just have time for a headline of what you make of it, and then we have to take a break. But let's do the headline.
I think the numbers, if anything, are understating the problem. I think they're based on very optimistic assumptions, and I think they're not they're to be taken seriously.
So when people, these actuaries, say these numbers are too speculative.
Well, you know, you want to take the best guess of the future you can make, and this is really the best guess. And again, I think it's really optimistic on a number of fronts. For example, they're assuming much less Medicare and Medicaid growth than we've actually experienced in the past, and certainly in the last 4 years.
All right, lots more to talk about after we come back. We're talking this hour about a looming $45 trillion deficit crisis and what that will mean for your retirement. Why is the government so unprepared? Do you have enough of a nest egg to retire without help from the government? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about runaway inflation, chaotic financial markets, and even political instability that could result from the retirement of the baby boomers. Who will be there to pay for your retirement? And does the government need to fundamentally restructure its entitlement programs? If so, how? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Lawrence Kotlikoff, professor of economics at Boston University and author of the new book, The Coming Generational Storm. And Jack Beattie's in the studio with us as well, On Point's news analyst and a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Larry, I want to give you a chance to expand a little bit on that headline. And also, if it comes down to pay now or pay later, when do we need to start?
Well, just on the issue of whether these numbers are too historical, the book really documents this conspiracy of the government agencies, and again, it's not an explicit one, it's really implicit, to understate the problem that we're facing. And you see this in most recently, Rick Foster, the chief actuary for Medicare, was threatened with being fired if he put out the true numbers about the cost of the Medicare drug benefit that's just been passed. So I think if you read the book, you'll see that actually this is very well documented, the size of this problem. We're not trying to jack this problem up, Jack, to make it to sell books. This is really a much bigger problem than people are thinking about, and it will generate huge fiscal and it's a fiscal problem, but it's going to generate huge financial problems and economics problems for the country unless we start dealing with this immediately. And the size of the problem, the size of the adjustments that you have to engage in are so big that one can kind of quickly come to the conclusion that the country is actually bankrupt, that we actually cannot raise taxes enough and cut benefits enough without completely destroying the economy to come up with this, with these funds that we need to come up with, unless we radically reform Social Security and Medicare. And that's what the book talks about, and comes up with two very sensible plans, I think, for doing that. But short of that, and we don't see either politicians, you know, the Republicans or the Democrats, talking about sensible reform and serious reform and painful reform, because that's what's required here, and radical reform. Short of that, we're going to have the government printing money like crazy to pay these bills. And, of course, that's going to lead us to major league inflation. And, you know, you might say this guy must be historical. I mean, what's he saying? You know, we haven't seen lots of inflation in the past. Well, if you look at other countries that have experienced these kinds of fiscal troubles, Argentina is the most recent. Look at Brazil today. Look at Russia a couple years ago. Look at Rome under Diocletian. They have all these governments that have gotten into major league fiscal problems have done one thing, which is to print money or print coins or mint coins or debase coins, and that's led to runaway inflation, and that's what's coming for the U.S.
So in terms of when do you start, we should have started decades ago. But as you know, Social Security in particular is the third rail of politics. Nobody wants to go near that because so many people would be upset by this generational contract.
Yeah, I think we have to let the old people in the country and the people closest to retirement understand that the problem's immense and that they're jeopardizing their own retirement incomes and well-beings if they don't fix this themselves. This is really everybody's problem. We can't let the current elderly completely off the hook and say, we're going to give you anything you want. Go to as many doctors as you want. Send us as many bills to pay for you as you want. Again, the last 4 years, every year, year after year, on average, Medicare benefits per beneficiary grew 7 times faster than the real wages of the workers paying those benefits. Just interact that with 77 million people going to get those higher benefits and think about what that means for your kids and your grandkids. If you're an older person, a member of AARP, retiree in Florida, think who you care about more, yourself or your kids. I think the answer, if you're really pushed on that question, you'll say your kids, and then you'll come around to trying to fix it.
And so that's where the pressure has to come from everybody realizing that this is serious.
We need to have a serious politician get up there and say we have a much bigger problem than people have talked about, have acknowledged, and we need to deal with it, and we need to deal with it in a in a very radical and different way from the ways we've dealt with it in the past. And that's what we come back to the plans in the book.
Well, you're also coming up against the sort of can-do American spirit of, well, no, this is not that bad. We can fix this. We can fix it with high tech. We can fix it with, you know, any number of other solutions. Why are those solutions not necessarily solutions?
Well, we talk in the book about immigration. We talk about technological change. We talk about getting inheritances from your parents. We talk about a number of so-called elixirs. And when you look at each one of those seriously, it just turns out that they're not likely at all to do what's needed. Immigration, for example, bringing in a lot more immigrants would actually cost us a little bit more than it would generate in terms of taxes, unless we brought in particularly high-skilled people, and there aren't those really to be found. They're in Europe and Japan, and they want to bring our high-skilled people to Europe and Japan. If you look at technological change, well, Social Security is indexed to real wages. So if real wages and if technological change is faster and real wages grow more rapidly, then Social Security benefits are going to be that much larger. Same with Medicare and Medicaid benefits. These things also grow up with a real go with a real rise with a real level of per capita income in the country. So again, technological change does not really buy you much. So unfortunately, this book kind of puts the dismal back in the dismal science, but we try and do it in a fun way, in a way that's entertaining, and we enjoyed writing it anyway.
And your remedies strike me as politically eclectic. There are things in there that conservatives would like and that liberals would like. Could you explain some of that blend of here's our solution? And
yeah, we really tried to think about solutions for both Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid that would appeal to both the Republicans and the Democrats. I'm neither a Republican nor a Democrat. My co-author, Scott Burns, who's a financial columnist for the Dallas Morning News, is neither either. I think, to tell you the truth, that politicians are basically lower life forms. They really are just focused on the next election. They couldn't care less about the next generation, seems to me. But in terms of the actual reform proposals, what we would do is pay off what we owe under the existing Social Security system with a federal retail sales tax that would get everybody on board except for the poor old people to pay off this bill. So, for example, Warren Buffett, when he goes and spends a huge amount of money on a big steak dinner in Omaha, he would have to pay tax on that with this retail sales tax. So his wealth, when he goes to spend his wealth, not just his income, but his wealth on consumption, that would be subject to taxation. If he leaves it to his kids and his kids spend it, again, this retail sales tax would collect money from him, from his wealth, and that would help pay off this liability that we have. Poor old people would be insulated because their Social Security benefits would be adjusted for inflation. So if the sales tax raises prices, they would get a cost of living increase. So everybody collectively is going to pay off this existing liability. And then we set up in our proposal, a rational, straightforward individual account system where everybody is invested in the same fully diversified global index fund. And the whole thing is managed by the Social Security Administration. So it's individual accounts. It's invested in real assets. But it's not like taking the public to Las Vegas and say, here, go gamble with your retirement. It's put everybody into an asset that makes sense, that's fully diversified, and you can invest at extremely low cost this way. And then everybody has their money taken out and transformed, again, through the Social Security Administration, into an inflation-protected pension in retirement. So you're not sent to the insurance company and told, go buy an annuity and pay whatever premiums these guys want to charge you. This is a sensible, rational way that an economist would set up a Social Security system. And it can be made as progressive as you'd like by having the government make matching contributions. And we're also taking the contributions and dividing it 50-50 between spouses so that there's dependent benefits for non-working spouses and partners. So this is exactly the way we should go. It's really the right fix for Social Security. And the provisions can be written on a postcard. We wrote it in eight simple, I think there may be 10 different provisions. And in the book, we actually put them on a one little page there in the book so that politicians don't have to spend too much time getting the point.
Well, you also point out that a lot more people are going to be reaching 100 than ever have before. And if, in fact, as has been argued, that 65 now is what 45 used to be, right. That's a very long time to not be working. Why not just delay retirement, particularly if you're a healthy 65-year-old?
Well, certainly a lot of people are going to have to do that. But in terms of the actual implications for our fiscal problem, it doesn't really buy you that much. You get more people in the workforce, that raises the tax base. On the other hand, that having more workers tends to lower the wages because it's increasing the supply of labor. So that actually offsets the increase in the tax base. So we've actually simulated these kinds of things in pretty sophisticated computer simulation models. Again, I'm an academic. And I've been studying this issue for 20 years since graduate school. And we study these things carefully. And this is what economics tells us is not feasible.
1-800-423-8255 is our number. And let's see what our listeners tell us, what they think. We're going first to Newton, Massachusetts. We want to hear from William. Hello, William.
Hello there. I'm an actuary with 40 years experience in this business. And I just want to make a few facts available to you, one of which is that the medical inflation, if it were to continue at the current rate, would be all of our GDP. So obviously it can't continue at the current rate of inflation. So therefore, it's kind of silly to project the current rate of medical inflation into any kind of a long-term study. Secondly, the concept of raising the retirement age to age 70 solves all Social Security's problems. It's equivalent to a one-third drop in the benefit. And if we do that in the year 2043, Social Security is good for another 100 years. So what we come down to is simply a problem with Medicare. And that is solved simply enough by having a single-payer health insurance product. The concept that he's providing us with is to have a sales tax, which hurts the middle income and lower paid people, rather than having a simple wage-based increase, if you want it, on the Social Security payroll tax collections.
Okay, William, thanks very much for the William plan. Let's throw that to Larry.
William, I disagree with everything you said, but not because I disagree from where you're coming from. I think that if you spent a little bit of time with me and read the book, you'd agree that I could persuade you. Let me just take each point in turn. The first thing you said was that we're overstating Medicare and Medicaid growth. That's to say that U.S. Treasury, which came up with this $51 trillion number, is overstating that. That's actually not the case. They're understating future Medicare and Medicaid growth. They're assuming that Medicare and Medicaid benefits per beneficiary will grow just one percentage point faster than real wages. Historically, they've grown 2.7 percentage points faster, and in the last 4 years, they've grown 3 percentage points faster. So the truth is we're actually understating by about two-thirds the true likely growth of Medicare and Medicaid. Another point you raised was just the true size of the Social Security liability. If you ask Steve Goss, who's the chief actuary for Social Security, how much of a tax hike would you need to cover all the projected benefits? So and include the trust fund as an asset, and that's arguable. But let's assume, for argument's sake, that the Social Security trust fund is available to pay benefits, and then you ask by how much would you have to immediately and permanently raise federal payroll taxes, the Social Security FICA tax, in order to come up with enough money in present value to cover this liability. Steve Goss, he'll tell you that the answer is 37%. And then if you ask him how much you have to cut benefits, he'll tell you it's 27%, immediate and permanent. So we've got an absolutely huge problem just with Social Security, and you don't have to take it from me. Just take it from one of your colleagues, Steve Goss, who's the chief actuary of Social Security.
All right, let's go to Fitchburg, Massachusetts now. We want to hear from Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm actually calling because I guess I feel like I'm sort of an average middle class individual who's working day to day, making a reasonable living, and I guess I've always gone through my life assuming that I was the one that was going to be responsible for my retirement, because I'm sort of responsible for how I'm going to eat and live next week. And I actually, as someone who owns a small business and, you know, sees where, you know, the tax dollars go, you know, not only in terms of, you know, W-2 type income, but, you know, all the things I pay behind the scenes as a business owner, I guess I don't understand and am offended by individuals who are over the age of, you know, whatever age it is that individuals get Social Security and actually collect when they don't necessarily need it. And I guess I would propose that just seems like, based on the philosophy of why we even have potentially a system like this of entitlement in the first place, that potentially we look at the base and say, why, in fact, do we have it? We have it to take care of what I believe to be the depauper, the people that cannot take care of themselves. And
Mike, so where would you draw that line, I wonder? Is there an income level at which you would draw that line or an asset level?
Well, I guess I would propose that to a certain extent we do put faith that we have systems in place that do come up with qualifications for those things. People have to qualify for welfare. So I don't understand why someone is mandated to go on welfare when they hit a particular age. So why not, you know, if we have to qualify for receiving particular benefits, why do we not, you know, put it to the powers that be to, you know, unfortunately I don't necessarily want to propose over too much bureaucracy, but to, you know, form a committee, take, you know, actuaries, people that actually can figure out, you know, what the appropriate costs of living are, you know, how, you know, what should someone be able to survive on, and maybe propose that limit.
Okay, well, Mike, appreciate the phone call.
Mike,
what do you think, Larry?
Mike, certainly Warren Buffett doesn't need Social Security, neither will Bill Gates when he hits that age. On the other hand, you have to realize that Social Security benefits given to the rich are relatively small relative to what they put in, because the Social Security benefit formula is progressive. And in addition, 85% of the benefits of rich Social Security recipients are subject now to the federal income tax. So if you really want to get, and also you have to realize that something like two-thirds of the elderly now are receiving 50% or more of their income from Social Security. So that you can't really get, by cutting benefits, you can't cut too much in the way of benefits without hurting a lot of people. So what I'm proposing here is a federal retail sales tax, which would hit Warren Buffett right when he spends his wealth. If he's got $40 billion and he spends $40 billion on consumption before he moves on in life, then he would pay, with a 10% sales tax, he'd pay $4 billion to the government to help pay off our Social Security liability. So I'm talking about a much bigger hit on the wealthy than just cutting off their Social Security benefits. And in terms of responding to the previous caller, William, what we propose in the book is putting the retail sales tax at 10% or so, but then eliminating 8 percentage points of the payroll tax. So we're actually taking Joe Sixpack and saying, look, we're going to cut your wage tax. We're going to put on a retail sales tax. It will turn out, really, that Joe Sixpack will end up better off under what we're proposing than under the current status quo.
All right, we're going to continue in just a moment. We're talking about financial planning in the face of a $45 trillion, maybe $51 trillion crisis. A trillion here, a trillion there, it does add up. Who will be there to pay for your retirement? And what are you doing to prepare for what may be a coming generational storm? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the coming generational storm and how you can protect your retirement. Is the government paying enough attention to these issues? Do you have enough of a nest egg to retire without government help? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking this hour with Lawrence Kotlikoff, professor of economics at Boston University and author of the new book, The Coming Generational Storm. And also here in the studio with us is Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. And Jack, you had a follow-up point you wanted to make to Mike.
Yes. You know, when you stand back and look at social insurance historically, It's really an adaptation to a market failure of capitalism. And that is, once people are in the past, once people's working lives were over, they were thrown out on the street. They were thrown out on the to their children took care of them. Poverty among the elderly, 30-40%. Medical indigence was a fact of life. People, when they needed it most and had least to pay, were just simply exhausted their means. So Social Security and Medicare have tried to deal with this, and we all have to stay in it together, and because, of course, otherwise social insurance really doesn't work. But what do we get out of it? What we get is a more decent society. What we get is a society where I think poverty among the elderly now is 10% or so. Medical indigence still exists for people who have to go into nursing homes, but that's because we don't have enough social insurance, not because, in other words, we have the principle at hand, we're just not paying for it. So, Mike, we're getting a lot from it. We're getting a more decent society.
Also, we've been talking so far about some of the big picture items, you know, what government can do. Many of the baby boomers, I can remember, never thought we were going to hit 30, much less retire. And now we are having to think about those things. So as individuals, what can we do other than stay healthy and hope for the best?
Well, I think we can try and be realistic about the need to save a whole lot more than we actually are for our old age, because taxes are going to be raised like crazy, benefits are going to be cut, and then the government's going to be printing money. So we have to think about higher taxes, benefit cuts, and inflation. And so that means think about working longer, saving a whole lot more, but also avoiding things that are like, for example, putting a lot of money into your 401k. If you put too much, well, suppose you think about putting extra money in that vehicle, and then you think about taking it out just when the government's raising its tax rates. Well, you might actually end up being hit with a big whammy, and the 401k can turn into a tax trap rather than a tax-saving vehicle. So I think people have to think carefully about how to save as well as how much to save. Also, what to save in. If anybody's holding long-term government bonds that are not inflation-indexed, they should sell those tomorrow morning. Maybe they can go on online and sell them this evening because the inflation rate's going to take off, interest rates are going to take off, interest rates are already nudging up, and the price of those long-term bonds is going to go down the tubes. You want to sell what you've got. You want to certainly not buy any long-term bonds at this point. And then you want to borrow as much as you can at these very low rates, and then try and take those funds and do something that's relatively safe with those funds. And I include putting it into an diversified index stock market investment as relatively safe. Also, buying housing if you don't own a house. This is a good time to do that if you can buy a house at a reasonable price, or putting on an addition on your house. But what you want to do is basically figure out the fact that interest rates are going to go up. So how are you going to take advantage of that? Well, you borrow as much as you can at these low rates, and then and certainly don't invest in anything that's going to be paying a low yield into the future, which is going to be making you repaid in watered-down dollars due to the inflation.
All right. I want to get in one more phone call to Red Wing, Minnesota. Bill's on the line. Bill, I need to ask you to be quick, though, please.
Okay. My chief complaint about our government is I'm already a pessimist that this country's already bankrupt and doesn't know it. But anyhow, I see all of our money being going overseas. We're missing out on outsourcing. I think our government should take tax advantages to make us have the companies keep their money here in the U.S. and increase our workforce, that increase our tax bases. And this NAFTA and world trade, that's actually a disastrous thing that's been happening to us. It's hurt both countries. Neither one of them has been really prospering because of NAFTA or this free world trade here. And our tax bases is going down. And our workforce is going down. You know, our government needs to take some steps to help us out there. And at the same time, our government could be fixing the incentives for the companies that are staying here in the United States to help contribute towards a 401k plan or whatever plan, retirement plan somebody has.
Okay, Bill, I need to stop you there because you've laid out a lot of interesting points and the time is short. You may want to speak to some of those, Larry, or Also, I want to get to the sobering question that you pose at the end of the book about whether the baby boomers who once thought they could save the world might actually be causing the end of the American dream. And that's some of what Bill was saying as well.
Yeah, I really think that we're responsible now. I think we're all baby boomers here, and that we need to we're sending the kids off to war. We're making the decisions. We're determining what should happen in the government. We have to take responsibility for our kids and our grandkids, and this is the time. We can't continue to look at these phony baloney deficit numbers. That's one of the things the book talks about, just the failure to look properly at what's happening here. You know, let me give you an example here. During the Clinton administration, everybody was patting himself on the back saying, well, gosh, we've got these big surpluses. We can take it easy. We don't have to worry about the future. But the fact of the matter is that with 77 million people in the workforce, baby boomers working, the surpluses should have been big. But the real question to be asked was, were they big enough? Indeed, they were far too small to deal with what's coming. So we have to look in a much more systematic fashion at our long-term problem here and deal with it as adults. The real question here is not Democrats versus Republicans, free traders versus not free traders. It's really grown-ups versus kids. That's what's going on here. We've got a generational war where the grown-ups have got all the ammunition, and they're just laying mines for the kids.
Well, Larry Kotlikoff, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Ernst Kotlikoff is professor of economics at Boston University and author of The Coming Generational Storm, What You Need to Know About America's Economic Future. And Jack Beatty, as always, a pleasure having you with us.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. And in just a moment, a look at the rash of hostage-taking that's occurring in Iraq. This is On Point. In recent weeks, hostage-taking of foreign nationals in Iraq has grabbed headlines around the world. Missionaries, contract workers, and journalists of multiple nationalities have been abducted. Some have survived their ordeals, many have not. Bruce Blythe is CEO of Crisis Management International and has been involved for years with hostage rescues. I asked him why hostage-taking has become the new tactic of choice among insurgents in Iraq.
Well, I would say probably the short answer is because it works. You know, the fact of the matter is that this is an opportunity for the haves to be overcome in some ways by the have-nots. Those people that don't have the military might, that sort of thing, it's happened in, you know, Colombia, it's happened all over the place where people kidnap others because they realize that they value human life and they can get some leverage on the people that they're trying to deal with.
Well, as you say, the word is leverage. A few people can accomplish something that maybe an army can't.
That's really true. And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, leverage, you know, of course it comes from physics, you know, where you put the least amount of effort in to get the maximum payoff. And, you know, I think the bad guys are starting to catch on to that. Al-Qaeda was estimated to spend about $500,000 on the 911 operation. And you look at the multi, who knows, billions, trillions of dollars that are still ongoing that came out of that. There's an excellent example of leverage. And certainly kidnapping, when ransom is involved, kidnap situations are one of those where it's very easy to do and you get very high leverage out of it.
Well, you also have to wonder about the role of the media here, because is hostage taking more powerful in some ways than the other casualties that come with war, because people can identify more with a few individuals who are being held, who are in harm's way?
Yes. You know, certainly the media is a mixed bag on this thing. You know, our experiences of kidnappings that we've handled in the past is that the captors tend to monitor the media to see what's going on. It's a way for them to be able to look out and see what kind of impact they're having. And the more that the media calls for the release and starts leaning on whether it be a company saying, oh, you care about money, you know, more than you do about people, or you care more about your political gain than you do about releasing our people, or, you know, that sort of thing. The more they see that kind of consternation going on behind the scenes, but it's played out, you know, in the media, then what happens is it reinforces them, actually, and they see that what they're doing is having an impact that they're really after.
Which is presumably why they release tapes showing them threatening these individuals. I mean, you see somebody with a knife at their throat, you're going to recoil at that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so what happens is that then, it, you know, on one hand, if you just give in to them, it's a double-edged sword here. If you just give in to them, we know that from having to pay ransom in cases, that if you're too quick to say, well, yeah, sure, you know, we'll give you money if you let these people go, and we're going to drop it on a riverbank somewhere or whatever. If you're too quick to do that, then they'll just up the ante. Say, hey, well, if we could get that, we'd probably get more. On the other hand, if you hold back too much, then you're liable to risk the possibility of people getting killed. So it's a delicate balance, and it's also a double-edged sword at the same time.
Well, and also for governments, because the official position is we don't negotiate for hostage release, but is that the way it really works?
Well, it's not just the government involved in these things. You know, you take the different corporations are involved over there. You know, corporations have kidnap ransom insurance, and as soon as somebody gets kidnapped, you know, there's a lot of people start to respond. You know, the insurance company responds, the company responds, the negotiators that are under retainer, you know, involved in these policies start to respond. There's some negotiations about can we pay some money from the, you know, the companies. The government with the United States is one faction. The government where they're kidnapped is another. You know, there's all kinds of people here, and who's going to have the last say-so? But many times, you know, the kidnap ransom insurance comes into play and helps sometimes get people released, even in political situations.
Well, and we've certainly seen the harm that these situations can cause for previous administrations. I'm thinking here of President Carter, the diplomats who were seized in Tehran in 1979. What are the lessons of history for you in terms of the best way to deal with hostage taking?
Well, there's really no win on this thing. Unfortunately, the people that are over there are there with, let's call it informed consent. They know what they're going into. And for people to take assignments, whether it be on a missionary, you know, or a goodwill mission, or whether they're to work and make more money they can there than they can over here, the fact of the matter is these people know that there's inherent risk when they take this. And so in spite of the fact that we know that, there is some political fallout when these people are taken. It's not quite as bad as people that are kidnapped out of their homes or something like that, where there's no inkling whatsoever, and all of a sudden that happens, and it's like, oh, my gosh. You know, thankfully that is something that doesn't happen nearly as often. But I think the best thing to do is to stick to your guns with the government at this point in time, and you got to say we will not negotiate with these people. Yes, there are other people that are going to try, like the corporations and things, that are going to try to get these folks out. But the fact of the matter is that we need to stick to our guns and keep an eye on the longer term. In the short term, if it happens to be you and the ones you love, you want to say, pay whatever you can, get them out of there. I don't care about the longer-term implications. The longer-term implications, though, is the more we give in to these folks, the more that the political fallout happens, the more that the money passes hands, the more that, you know, troops pull out and people pull out like this is happening out of Iraq right now, the more they get reinforced. Well, guess what? It's going to cause them to do it more.
So what are foreign nationals having to do these days to protect themselves in Iraq, and what would be your advice to those people?
Well, first of all, I think you need to have the bare minimum people in there. You need to take the look and say, okay, if in fact you're going to be there, let's take every precaution we possibly can to keep you from being isolated or being kidnapped. If in fact you are kidnapped, these folks do need to have some training, some orientation about what do you do while you're kidnapped to help increase the likelihood you're going to survive. Although they may have a little bit of influence, but they certainly don't have control in these situations. I think probably the best thing you can do is informed consent. Just kind of say, hey, you're accepting a risky proposition, and it may come down, and we'll do everything we can to help you out. But there is inherent risk here, and I wish it wasn't there, but it is.
Thank you, Bruce.
My pleasure.
Bruce Blythe is CEO of Crisis Management International. He spoke with us from Atlanta. I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point.